From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a listen back to some of the most memorable conversations we've had so far this year. And our first pick is likely someone you are quite familiar with. Since 1975, we've heard Nina Totenberg's voice on National Public Radio. The longtime legal affairs correspondent is considered a founding mother of NPR, with an unparalleled perspective of the law and its highest court. I spoke with Nina back in January on the heels of her book, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships. The memoir includes a nearly five-decade friendship with the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But as you're about to learn, Nina tells me this memoir is more than just one friendship, but about beloved relationships that have anchored and shaped her life. Well, Nina, thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm just delighted to be here.
So, as you're probably well aware, you're considered a founding mother of NPR. I actually read a book about you alongside Cokie Robert, Susan Stamberg, and Linda Wertheimer, authored by Lisa Napoli last year. I'm just curious, how does it feel to be on the receiving end of a term like this, which is of endearment and deep respect?
Well, the longer it lasts, the worse it gets. So being a founding mother wasn't so bad 20 years ago, but now it's a little bit, okay, let's just move on to calling me something else.
Yeah. Given that your time with NPR goes back, you know, to 1975, and soon after that, you began reporting on the law and the Supreme Court, and obviously we now know you as a longtime legal affairs correspondent. What interested you about covering the law in the highest court more so than perhaps other beats?
Well, you know, when I started at NPR, I was hired to be the legal affairs correspondent, and that included, let me just say, that included the Supreme Court, of course, but the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, the Justice Department, any scandal that occurred, every impeachment up until Trump, and even some of Trump, but mainly up until Trump, all political scandals eventually had a legal twist, so I was almost always an anchor for live hearings and all of that, and the intelligence community. So I had this huge portfolio. And when I came to NPR, we only had one program. It was All Things Considered. It started at 5, not 4, and it was an hour and a half, not 2 hours. Now we have three flagship two-hour programs every day with significant rollovers. So we update them, we change them as need be during the time it's being heard on the West Coast versus the East Coast. All of that has made it so that I could not conceivably do all the things I did back then now, because we have so many more platforms, so many more programs, that as much as I would love to cover politics, I even used to cover presidential campaigns a bit, I couldn't possibly do that. The Supreme Court is a full-time occupation if you have to do radio, digital, podcasts, social media, and anything else that comes along.
So with all of that going on, does it ever get boring?
Not really. Sometimes it's really hard. I've been reading lots of briefs in a case involving Google and Twitter and whether they have complete immunity from lawsuits for all practical purposes. And they're very hard. And I've get home at night feeling like I've been beating my head against a brick wall. But if it doesn't penetrate my head, I'm not going to be able to describe it in the simplest of terms to regular folks, which is what I do for a living.
Given that you've been writing and reporting for more than 50 years, it's safe to say it is a skill of yours. But what's different or what's even challenging about writing a memoir?
Well, what was most challenging about writing a memoir was doing it while holding down a day job. And that was the most difficult part. And I have to say that, you know, in addition to nights and weekends, I did a lot of it on vacations. In fact, even this August, when I had already finished the book and it was being printed, I signed 6,000 book plates.
Wow.
So that people would buy the book.
Did your hand cramp at all?
I did it every night, and I listened to books on tape while I did it, not mine, obviously. I would listen to some mystery story, and I would do it for about an hour, and I could do about 300 or 400 in that time. And if I did it every night that way, I had a nice long vacation in August, and I got about 6,000 book plates done.
That is impressive. When did you land on the title, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships?
Well, you know, this is a book that's about more than Dinners with Ruth or even my friendship with her. But in the last analysis, the publisher came up with the idea. I figured that they had paid me very well to write the book and that they should get the title of their choice. And the second part, A Memoir on the Power of Friendships, was my contribution.
Right, because you do include other friendships as well.
Lots of other friendships, including not just with my NPR sisters, but with my blood sisters, who I talk to every week for a long time, at least once. And sometimes the three of us talk together. If we manage to organize a Sunday afternoon hour together, we do that. It's, you know, we don't live in the same cities. And so it's a good way to stay connected. And of course, you know, there were lots of justices along the way who became my professional friends and in some senses, personal friends too.
Right. Given that the relationships that you're talking about, from sisters to friends, these span decades and multiple chapters in all of your lives, what felt right at this point in your career, at this point in your life, to write a memoir and a book about it?
You know, I to be truthful about this, I would not have written this book if my husband hadn't basically weighed in and said he thought I should write it. I had said no to books for years and years and years. And I really felt he was very clear about the fact that he didn't want me to write a book, that I worked too hard as it is, and he wanted my time, not have me up in the attic writing a book. And so he wandered in one day when I was having a conversation with the CEO of Simon & Schuster, Jonathan Karp, and the publisher of Simon & Schuster, and I had agreed to at least talk to them. And David, my husband, was my ace in the hole. He was my, you know, and they kept getting rid of all my objections. They would give me a person to help with this or that or the other thing. I wouldn't have a deadline. Well, of course, as soon as I signed the contract, I had a deadline. But on that day, Jonathan Karp came up with a framework for a book that I thought I actually might be able to write. And that was the friendships, particularly of the women of my generation, when we weren't trying to break a glass ceiling. We were trying to get a foot in the door. And so I thought that the idea was a doable idea, but I was still saying no. And I had my mouth literally open to say, and my husband doesn't want me to do it. And he says, I think you should write this book. So that was the end of my objections. And therefore it got done.
We thank him for the nudging to get you over that literary finish line. You give it that your memoir is really putting writing to very personal memories. What have these interviews and these talks in front of an audience added to your very personal experience and friendships with many people, including the late Justice Ginsburg?
Well, I do think that friendship, whether it's friendship with your family or friendship with your, quote, friends or your professional friends, is the basis of living a life. And I came to sort of formulate that idea in the process of writing this book. And in doing that, I think it crystallized how much friendship has meant to me from everybody in my life, including my husband's. And I think when you read the book, you will see in very concrete terms how, in a crisis, these are the folks who rush in to help you and to shore you up and make you able to keep your head above water. You know, they did that. My family and my friends did that when my first husband, Floyd, had a terrible accident and was significantly disabled for about 5 years until his death. And I try to do that for other people now. And I'm not sure I would have known to do that without learning the lesson of friendship from my friends, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And the fact that the first time you two met was before your days at NPR, even, you know, well before her days in the Supreme Court, why do you think your professional relationship began as one evolved into such a strong friendship over nearly five decades?
You can never entirely measure these things, and certainly in the beginning, I was the apprentice trying to learn something about law and the Supreme Court from somebody significantly older than, more than a decade older than I am, and who had already achieved a great deal but was not really recognized yet. She was a professor at Rutgers Law School, and she had, I called her about the first brief she filed in the Supreme Court. And so, although our lives were hardly parallel, I mean, hers was really significant. Mine was perhaps occasionally journalistically significant, but nothing like hers. But our lives increasingly came closer together after she was appointed to the D.C. Court of Appeals and moved from New York to Washington, and then to the Supreme Court, where I was covering her now for the first time and trying to figure out how to keep journalistic boundaries at the same time that this woman who'd become my friend could stay my friend. And we became even closer because we were able to have those boundaries. And we had wonderful husbands who complimented each other and complimented us to boot. And it just evolved over time until the last year of her life, when by then her husband had died and her daughter Jane and her son James would come to D.C. to help be with her in her apartment. But she wasn't even with them all the time, but she would come to dinner almost every Saturday night for that last period of her life when we were all in lockdown. And because my husband is a surgeon and had been her medical confidant for years, she knew she would be safe at our house. And so did her daughter, son, and her granddaughter, too.
You became like a pod, you know, like many of us created during the pandemic.
Exactly. We were a pod. That's exactly what we were.
How were you able to compartmentalize, or I don't even know if that's possible, the loss of a friend who is like family, while the significance of Justice Bader's death and the vacancy that it created on the Supreme Court, how are you able to look at them differently? And or did you? Was it even possible?
Well, they're two separate things. One is, you know, genuine personal grief at the loss of a friend. And the other is something I had thought about quite a bit as she became more frail. And I think every other person who covered the court had thought about it. I mean, I had pre-written her obituary countless times and had to then throw them out or update them. But, you know, when I went away on vacation in 2020 to Cape Cod for about 3.5 weeks, I wasn't sure she'd be alive when I got back, and I wrote not just the newest version of the obituary for digital, for radio. I did a version that was about the politics of it, because that would be the first thing that would come up. But I also did a personal remembrance that was the shorter version was on the radio, and it was still pretty long. It was 7 or 8 minutes, and the longer version, which was more than twice that long, was in the digital version. So I had thought through all of these elements, including anticipating how very sad I was going to be at losing a friend of so many years. And ironically, you know, Ruth died exactly a day after, I think, a year and a day after Cokie died. So I had a lot of time to think about the loss of two such close personal friends.
Yeah, anchors in your life, you know, especially with friendship and support over the decades. You know, that tribute that you wrote was incredibly touching, and it was very personal, as you say, but it also did receive some criticism about the friendship being a conflict of interest, given obviously you're a legal affairs correspondent covering the Supreme Court. Did you anticipate that criticism ahead of writing this obituary and this tribute?
About the tribute, I guess I anticipated some of that, but I consider it not worth perseverating over. I mean, the fact is, when you know somebody really well, and I knew her really well, and I knew Justice Scalia really well, too, and they were at opposite ideological ends of the court, but I knew them personally very well, you know so much more than you would have known otherwise, and you can enrich what you write about them when they're on the court. You write so much more profoundly about them and with greater understanding of what makes them tick than other people who don't have those relationships. And I consider it a great asset to my understanding of my beat and what I was able to bring to it and to bring to the people who read what I write and listen to what I say on the radio or on TV.
Is covering the Supreme Court different following Justice Ginsburg's passing?
Well, it's different than at any time in my years of covering the court, because I have never covered the court when there was such a lopsided ideological balance or lack of balance on the court. I mean, there's always been a center, and there is no center anymore for all practical purposes. The court would tilt one way or the other. It was definitely more liberal when I started covering the court in 1969, I guess it was, pretty much. But over time, it grew increasingly conservative, but nothing like the conservatism of today. So what was, you know, considered sort of fringe views, let's say, 10 years ago, is now in much more the prevailing view of at least five of the justices on the court. And so it's a very different proposition covering a court that's so ideologically riven and so dominated by a very hardline conservative view.
Well, with that, I would love your thoughts on one of the biggest decisions last year that started with a draft leak of the Dobbs decision that it effectively overturned Roe versus Wade, as we all know. I mean, but given that you know the nuances and the structure of the Supreme Court in a way that very little of us understand, with that lens, how do you think a leak of this magnitude was even possible?
Well, first of all, speaking of conflicts of interest, let's just put something on the table here. Journalists survive and prosper by getting people to talk to them. So having a leak of this magnitude at the Supreme Court has such repercussions for the way the institution functions within its own parameters. I mean, I've talked to many people who work at the court, who've worked at the court for a very long time, who are contemplating leaving because of the atmosphere at the court after the leak. And even the justices themselves, you can hear it in their voices. Justice Thomas said he doesn't trust anybody anymore. The conservative justices themselves don't agree on many things. They may agree on an outcome, but not how to get there. The liberal justices, for all practical purposes, in the ideologically divisive cases, don't have a prayer. So it's a very different institution. And in part, it's because of that leak. Not entirely, but in part, it's because of that leak. I've often said that it's the only major journalistic coup that I'm very glad was not mine, because everybody who looked at me would immediately run the other direction. I couldn't get anybody to talk to me about anything. And you do need to know more than the words on a page. You need some sense of the institution. It is the third branch of government, the judiciary. And the fact that it's so, at the moment, such an unhappy place, in part because of that leak, is, I think, problematic, let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm gathering is you would have handled that situation differently. Would you go as far to say as publishing this leak that it was irresponsible?
No, I don't think you can say that. I mean, our job is to gather the news. Now, we know that there were two people's names on the story, and one of them doesn't cover the court, so I assume it came in initially through him in some way or another. It could have come over the transom, for all I know, and or in some fashion like that. But, it's not for me to decide what's good to know, for people to know and not know. That would be the ultimate in censorship. which is why I'm very glad that nobody offered me this story, because I would have had to have done the story.
Given that, the trajectory of your career, it really has given you this really unique and even unparalleled perspective in some of these biggest moments in history. I go back to your groundbreaking reporting about Anita Hill during Justice Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearing. That was back in 1991. And I'm curious what that level of deep reporting experience on that testimony and the aftermath, how did that shape your journalistic approach and even your understanding when covering Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony during Justice Brett Kavanaugh's hearing?
Well, I do remember sitting there on the day that she testified and hearing people say things like, well, it's over. And I thought, no, it's not. You know, we've seen this before. And then Judge Kavanaugh hasn't testified. We don't know what he's going to say or what he's going to do. And we do know that politicians fight very hard sometimes for their people or causes. And I was not particularly surprised that there was not any real investigation of the charges in any way that would satisfy people.
What struck you most about these moments in history that on the one hand are deeply personal and intimate, but they're also intertwined with the public eye? You can't not think about the confirmation hearing of Justice Brett Kavanaugh without also thinking about the confirmation hearing of Justice Clarence Thomas. The two are intertwined, even though these are very individual, personal accusations and hearings.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are some significant differences. Anita Hill worked for Clarence Thomas, and although she was a young woman, she was a grown person. The allegations against Brett Kavanaugh basically concerned his latter years in high school. And there were allegations about him in college, but they were never actually and significantly investigated. And I suspect you're going to hear about that for on and off for years to come, that there will always be new wrinkles coming up about the Kavanaugh hearings. But there are some other similarities. One is that the Republicans were willing to wage complete war on behalf of their nominee. And the Democrats in both cases really significantly mishandled the way they dealt with this. And they made themselves and their cause less able to prevail by their sort of fumbling. And that was true in both these cases. So I'm not drawing any conclusions about the Kavanaugh hearings. I just think there were differences, but there were some also overbroad similarities.
If you didn't pursue journalism, do you think there's another field where you would find the same level of fulfillment?
Well, you know, when I was young, I think I would wanted to be a detective. And that seemed obvious that I couldn't do that because there were no women detectives back then that I had ever heard of. So it doesn't seem a huge leap to say that I would then say, well, I could be a detective for the public, essentially, and tell people what's going on and be a witness to history, and sometimes be an investigative reporter as well. And that's, I think there's a, for me anyway, that was a leap that was not that hard to understand.
Yeah, I can completely understand that as well. And given that the field that we're in, I mean, it's not just a job, it is part of our identity. And I can't have that identity for myself without also thinking about the relationships that I created along the way. So just ending with your memoir, what do you hope readers take away about the power of friendship?
I often tell graduates when I give a commencement speech that for all the things that I am telling them on this day and that the people who are speaking to them on this day about the importance of their profession and this and that and the other thing, the most important thing to know is that at some point in your life, you will be in a crisis. And if you have been a good person, people will come and help you in that crisis and through that crisis. And the best lesson to learn from that is how you can do that for somebody else.
Nina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That is my conversation with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg about her book, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Sacramento Kings' playoff appearance was a first for a lot of fans after a postseason drought of 16 years. One particular person, though, has been with the Kings since day one. Gary Gerald has been the radio announcer for the Kings since the first game in Sacramento back in 1985. And the G-man himself has seen it all, the good, the bad, and yes, those very ugly dark seasons. I spoke with the voice of the Kings back in March as Gary crossed a huge milestone, broadcasting his 3,000th game. So, Gary or G-Man, I'm just curious, where did you get your nickname G-Man?
It's a question that I'm frequently asked, and I really don't have a good answer. It started way back in the days when I was still working at KCRA television, which means it would have been in the early mid-70s, somewhere along in there. And for whatever reason, it seemed to stick. And here we are all of these years later, and I still answer to G-Man.
You've had such a wonderful trajectory in sports journalism and just sports. You grew up in Michigan. Did you ever think you would be doing what you're doing today and at the young age of 82?
I certainly, as a youngster, remember that all I wanted to do was be a sports broadcaster. And this was at a time when colleges and universities did not provide broadcasting curriculum. And so I was very fortunate that at a very young age, unfortunately, my father passed when I was 12 years old. My mother was frequently ill, and I was an only child, and I was left to fend on my own, and frequently would live with neighbors or our pastor's family in our church. But the bottom line was that a small town radio station in Midland, Michigan became my second home. And I virtually visited that radio station on a daily basis. I would spend every night there. And at a very young age, I was afforded the opportunity to have my own show as a teenager. And it kind of evolved out of that. And the fact that I always wanted to be a sports guy somehow came to be. And I'm one of the very fortunate few, I gather, that over a lifetime have been able to do exactly what I always wanted to do.
Do you ever think about taking your show on the road and joining another team? You've stayed with the Kings for so long, since 1985.
Well, Sacramento has been our home since the mid-60s, 1965. And when the Kings came to Sacramento in 1985, I was overjoyed because it was the first major sports franchise to make Sacramento a home. And I've always enjoyed Sacramento, and I've had no desire to transplant and go somewhere else. And the fact that the Kings have been here now for 38 years, and I've been blessed with the opportunity to be a broadcaster with that organization, has just been something that I think dreams are made of.
Take us back to that era in 1985. What was it like to be a basketball fan here?
Well, if you were a basketball fan prior to the arrival of the Kings, your only opportunity to watch basketball were through high school, some limited college play, UC Davis, Sac State, most notably, And then there were a handful of AAU teams and independent tournaments, the March of Dimes tournament, things like that. And so it was really kind of slim pickings. And then suddenly it all gets transformed. And the excitement that when the Kings came in Sacramento in the mid-80s, 1985, I always hearken back to the preceding season, the end of the season in the spring of 85. The Kansas City Kings were making a West Coast appearance to play a couple of games, either in Los Angeles or in Oakland against the Golden State Warriors. And they scheduled a stop in Sacramento and had a workout scheduled at American River College. And I remember just being blown away walking into that gym. It's not big. It seats probably at that time around, I think, 3,200, something like that. And it was crammed to the rafters with now Kings fans who were so excited to see the Kansas City Kings in person. And I remember the looks were just incredulous on the parts of the faces of a Reggie Theus, LaSalle Thompson, Eddie Johnson, Larry Drew, members of that first team. They were getting standing ovation when they walked on the floor and when they were doing their routine stretching and things like that to get ready for a practice session. And they were just totally blown away. They couldn't believe there was that kind of support to greet them in Sacramento. And that's where it all began. And I think it was a streak of almost 500 games, 497. The first 497 games that the Kings played in Sacramento were all sold out. And that still stands as one of the longest sellout streaks in NBA history. So it's gratifying to see how it's evolved over this long period of time. It was just so exciting when they first arrived. And now with the resurgence of the Kings, it's really getting exciting once again.
You know, given that, I mean, what you've experienced, this trajectory with the Sacramento Kings since its inception here in Sacramento, I mean, it's just so special. After almost 40 years of calling Kings games, do you still get butterflies over certain games or moments?
I don't know that I would call it butterflies. There's always apprehension, and you always want your team to have success. And the fact that this organization has now gone for the last 16 years without making the playoffs has become the longest drought in all of professional sports. And everybody is so anxious to see that drought broken. And I've referenced it to being like wandering in the desert for a decade and a half. And finally, an oasis is in sight. And I see palm trees and I see fountains and sparkling water. And I'm ready to dive in. And there will be anxiety and there will be angst and there will be drama and there will be nights when you excel and there'll be nights when you wish you had the opportunity to do it all over again. But the fact that it's creating excitement, we're getting sellout crowds on a consistent basis once again, it's a fun team to watch. And I'm truly excited about, you know, everybody's kind of being resurrected here after a dry spell. We frequently talk about the passion of Kings fans, and it's been exemplary over the years. But there's nothing like winning, and everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon, wants to be part of the fun. And I get to be part of that fun on a nightly basis. And it's something that keeps these old bones going and just thoroughly enjoying what I get the opportunity to do.
You have quite the unique experience of, I'm using your metaphor of being parched for about 16 seasons now. You know, given that you're that radio voice that really comforts fans, guides the team, how do you get energized over the last 16 seasons when you've had, you know, your fair share of times when the team is down and out?
It's been a huge challenge. There's no question. You want success. And when you don't have success on a regular basis, it has a tendency to beat you down. And I joke about the fact that I used to be 6'4", but now I'm 5'8". And I've been pounded down here over the years with some of the struggles of the Kings. But if you're a professional broadcaster, in my mind, you find a way, and I've always tried to be very fair. Yes, you support and you want your home team to have success. And yes, you can be called a homer in terms of being a broadcaster. But by the same token, if the Kings happen to be stinking the joint up, I'm going to tell you that they're stinking the joint up. And I think that that's the only thing that a good broadcaster can do. My job, as I see it, is to try to inform, to try to entertain. to try to create a picture in your mind so that if you want to try to envision what's happening through the radio, you can do that. And it's a huge challenge when your team is struggling for success. I go back even further, you know, just over a decade ago when it looked like the Kings were going to be uprooted and moved to another city.
That's right.
And the despair that was felt amongst all the fans, people in the organization, as a broadcaster, those were the toughest games that I've ever had to do. And each game, you know, you kind of had to have a little chat with yourself before you went on the air and say, okay, you know, don't let this drag you down. Don't let it impact your broadcast. Try to find a way to, you know, be positive, even though it is so gloomy in what the future looks like for this organization. Thank goodness they were able to survive. Vivek Ranadive comes to the rescue, buys the team from the Maloofs. Now we have this magnificent Golden One Center in the heart of downtown Sacramento that I think is really revitalizing the downtown core area, much as we hoped it would. Then you look back over the last couple of years, and with COVID, because we couldn't travel, we were doing games on a remote basis. Some of those were almost as difficult as the time leading up to whether or not the Kings were going to be uprooted and moved. Because in the building for home games, you had cutouts, you had no fans. And because we weren't traveling and calling games remotely, there was no energy to feed off of. That was a very difficult time as well. But now we seemingly, in the past, we started traveling again in the last 6 weeks of last season and all of this year. And so it's good to be back. You get to see, you know, broadcasters and friends that you've come to make over the years on the road. You get to visit your favorite hole-in-the-wall dining places and things like that. And all of that combined with some modest success has really rekindled, I think, my passion for Kings basketball.
We're having this conversation under drastically different circumstances in the very, very best way after, you know, a drought of 16 seasons, and you marked this history-making 3,000th game. That must be so special that it's in a season that is so long overdue.
Well, it is very special. I don't consider myself to be a big ego person, but I would be lying if I didn't say that, you know, reaching 3,000 Kings games is a very satisfying milestone from my personal standpoint. And the fact that we were able to win the 3,000th game on the road, and the fact that the Kings coaches and the organization saw fit to get me down from my broadcast position immediately. I got a text. This never happens. I got a text in the fourth quarter saying, as soon as the game is finished, get to the locker room as quickly as you can. And I'm thinking, I wonder what this is about. Something is up. So I end up making my way quickly to the locker room, and some of the staff are outside the locker room in Oklahoma City. And I'm saying, you know, what's going on? And I don't know. They're either they don't know, or they're being really good at being coy and playing it off. And then we get in the locker room, and after wins, something that the Kings have newly initiated this season is awarding a player the defensive player of the game. It's a beautifully addressed medallion, Kings logo, full of glitz and glitter on a heavy, heavy gold chain. And it's quite an honor for the defensive player of the game. So Jordy Fernandez, who is the associate head coach with Mike Brown, he's the one who makes the decision, or who hands it out. And he's talking about, you know, in defense, communication is important. We've got a communicator here who tonight celebrated his 3,000th broadcast. And G-Man is the man who gets the chain. And the team goes around you and they take pictures, and they got a fog machine, and they got all kinds of blitz and bling and stuff going on. I have to tell you, it was not only was an extraordinary experience, it was probably one of the most memorable experiences of my lifetime. It was absolutely mind-boggling.
You have been with the Kings through just, you know, turbulent waves over the decades. And the reality is, we've had this conversation multiple times on Insight that, you know, this season, there are people in Sacramento who have never really experienced what a city is like during a playoff run. It's been 16 seasons.
You look back to that run of 8 years, eight consecutive years in the playoffs under Rick Adelman, and a couple of the most memorable playoff series, most notably the one with the Lakers in 2002 that went to overtime in a seventh game before it was decided. The atmosphere at the old Arco Arena, it's off the charts. And people get swept up in it. And it's such a rallying cause and cry for not only Kings fans, but I think people get swept up in the enthusiasm. And it's something that a region shares. And it's something that we haven't had, you know, for such a long period of time that there's no question in my mind that, you know, people are going to go bonkers. I mean, they're just going to be beside themselves with joy. Golden One Center will never have experienced what it will be like on the night that the first playoff game is played in that building. And it will be literally vibrating, I guarantee you.
Yeah, it is an underdog story. You also said that you're not afraid to be critical of the Kings' performance on the court. Where would you rank this current team from years past?
Well, it's closing in on ranking behind. I mean, the Kings have only been to the playoffs three different spans. We mentioned the 8 years under Adelman. They had one season in the mid-90s where they played Seattle. And then some people forget that the very first year the Kings were in Sacramento, they did make it to the playoffs thanks to a late season push. They didn't have a winning record that year, but they got in. They were swept in three games by the Houston Rockets. So right now, I think this team is starting to create, you know, memories and ties to the early years of success under Rick Adelman, which was, I think it was 1999, maybe the first season or 2000 that he was with the Kings and they got into the playoffs. You get into the playoffs and it becomes a different game. The intensity is ratcheted up so much. And the old cliche about how every possession is so meaningful is absolutely true. And you can't make mistakes. And the window for opportunity is a small one. And then you get your foot in the door. And then you have to learn how to win in this scenario. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, there are no givens. When you start, you have to learn how to win in a playoff atmosphere. And there are only a couple of guys on the Kings roster who've had playoff experience in the past. And so for the bulk of the team, they're going to find out it's a whole different world in terms of intensity and meaningful possessions. So it'll be an exciting time. It'll be a learning time. But I love Mike Brown, the head coach of the Kings, his approach. He doesn't just want to make the playoffs and end the drought. He wants to have success in the playoffs.
Just listening to you talk about, one, your passion for broadcasting, your passion for basketball, specifically the Kings, I'm just curious, what is life like for you on your days off or during the off season? What do you do?
Well, for close to 40 years, I worked network television and I did primarily motorsports in the off season. And so I was basically traveling every weekend of the summer. So now that I've pulled out of the motorsports as of 6-7 years ago, slow things down a bit. I spend a lot of time on the golf course. I enjoy that immensely. But the excitement of this kind of revitalization of the Kings and their success of this season makes off days interesting. I always enjoy watching other teams play through NBA League Pass and through the various networks. We get a chance to watch teams on a national basis, on a nightly basis. So if we're not playing, I'm watching a handful of games every night and keeping an eye on what teams are doing. And so it's basketball still takes a very, very big part of my life. And I'm proud and blessed to have the opportunity.
Yeah, it's a vigorous schedule. And especially after the pandemic, remembering those like fan cardboard cutouts, you know, in the stands and not really being able to travel, you know, after that pause and that hiatus, do you enjoy traveling with the team? Because it can also get grueling, I would imagine.
It is grueling. And a lot of people think, oh, it's so glamorous. And that's not always the case. You tell me how glamorous it is when you're walking off a bus that you come from the airport and it's 8 below zero in Minneapolis and you're arriving at the hotel at 2 in the morning and you get your bags and unpack and you're turning the lights out at 3:30 or something like that. But you become conditioned to it. And that's part of it. And I do enjoy it. My one concern, Vicki, is that my wife's health is not good, and I worry about her when I'm on the road. She maintains that, you know, she can still fend for herself, and she has done very well over this last season while we have been traveling. But it is a concern. But that's part of the aging process. And it's something that, you know, we all just face and you adapt to as best you can. So it's there are challenges that come with the travel. It can be grueling at times. But when you're having success, and particularly, I mean, the Kings have the best road record in the Western Conference right now. And I love that. I mean, I've always maintained road wins are the best. There's a great atmosphere when you're home and the joint's rocking and you win on the home floor. But when you're on the road and you're in an adversarial position and you got, you know, 18, 20,000 fans rooting against you and you pull off the victory on the road, there's nothing quite like that feeling. And I love it. And I still maintain road wins are the best.
Do you have like an all-time must-have favorite meal when you're on the road?
I'm pretty much a hole-in-the-wall type of a guy. I mean, I have favorite pizza places. I have hot dog places. Places where I go and, you know, maybe it's nachos one night. Maybe it's some kind of pasta, whatever. You know, lots of them. You kind of find your niches over the years in various cities. And occasionally, you know, it's a nice, you know, formal type dinner. But I'm kind of satisfied very easily. I can be just as happy with a hot dog. And some nights it's a PB&J when you come off the airplane and a bag of chips in your hotel room. And that's good enough for me. I love it.
I feel like with how much you've traveled that you can have a G-Man food blog. So maybe something you can do if you ever choose to retire from the Sacramento Kings in broadcasting. You know, finally, a big piece of this, the reason why you've been with the Kings for so long and also love Sacramento. I mean, you talk about the city, especially the fans, given that you have traveled to every NBA city every single season, with the exception, obviously, of the pandemic. You've said it many times. We have the best fans. Why is that?
Well, I don't know that I have an answer for that. It's just somehow there is a connection. And the hardcore group of Kings fans who've been there through thick and thin have just been so passionate and so supportive. When the team hasn't been good enough to deserve, frankly, that kind of support. And somehow the connection has been made. And now that they're enjoying success again, some of those people that have been on the fringe, they're jumping in feet first and they're enjoying the ride. So it's marvelous. You know, there are a handful of cities that you go to where there is a very passionate fan base. It can be very raucous, but I still hear countless references to this day from people when I'm on the road, hearkening back to the old Arco in Sacramento. And the fact that it was built kind of on the cheap, it had the wooden plywood floors, people would stomp their feet. We called it Arco Thunder. And that has stuck in the memory of so many people. It was such a tough environment for opposing teams to play in. And I still hear references virtually on a daily basis. We're on the road. Somebody will say, man, I just remember how tough it was to play in the old Arco. Well, hopefully now, they're going to start to be saying that about Golden One Center in Sacramento. It's a great facility, and the fans have been responding, and the sellout crowds have been, you know, multiplying, and it's just a great atmosphere, and it's a great place to watch basketball. And so we're excited about that.
Gary, it's been wonderful. Thank you for making the time, and congratulations on such an incredible accomplishment. 3,000 games.
I guess that just means I'm old, but I've enjoyed the ride, and I've said so many times, I am truly blessed, and I love that I have the opportunity to do what I do. And knock on wood, or whatever, hopefully we can keep it rolling for a while longer at least.
Gary Gerald has been the radio voice of the Sacramento Kings since their first game back in 1985. I spoke with the G-Man himself as he surpassed a sports broadcasting milestone, calling 3,000 games with the Kings, an accomplishment which began nearly 40 years ago. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. I hope you enjoyed this special best of edition, taking a listen back to some of the best conversations we've had so far this year. And with that, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Crow Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Nada. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.